Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, everyone, this morning. We followed the House of Israel, did we not, at our last study into the wilderness of the peoples, that place where the influence of the papacy has scorched the earth of all spiritual fruitfulness and turned it into a dry and arid land. And the centre of that desolate and desert place is Europe, where the harlot sits. And it's more than just a spiritually barren place. It is a waste and howling wilderness of hostile enemy territory. And that's where the house of Israel will be taken, we believe, from a scriptural perspective. We saw how that Elijah will congregate the Jewish people there and also bring them into the new covenant, just as Moses did, bringing them into the old covenant at the time of the first Exodus. We saw how the trials of the journey will take its toll, and that Yahweh will use that experience to purge out the rebels, but also to bring the remnant that are left to the fullness of faith. And we also saw, did we not, that if we are to have the privilege of assisting with Elijah in that day and instructing the house of Israel, that we first must learn to write the law of God upon our own hearts and minds. And we suggested, did we not, that when we write the principles of the truth upon our minds, that God then is able, through the power of providence in our lives, to fashion circumstances and events that will write those same things on our hearts. And that movement, that development from intellectual knowledge to experiential knowledge is the journey that all the saints of God must go on. But we made the observation that God can't work a work in our lives to so write those things upon our hearts if we haven't first written them into our minds. And that's why we open our Bibles, brothers and sisters. We open our Bibles so that we might think like God, but so that God in turn might work a work in our lives. Imagine having the privilege of being able to deal with those very matters and those very ideas in the house of Israel as they journey during this time. Do you know, when we consider the first Exodus, we realize that although there were only 11 days from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea, because so says Deuteronomy chapter 1 verse 2, that the children of Israel wandered in that wilderness for 40 years until the rebels were purged. And we have reason to believe that the epoch of probation that Israel went through in the first Exodus will be the same period that the house of Israel will wander for in the wilderness of the peoples. Now, we know from Scripture that Numbers 14 verse 33, for example, says, "Your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years." So that the term was quite explicit, wasn't it, about the first Exodus? And again, in Psalm 95 and verse 10, it says, 40 years long was I grieved with this generation and said, it is a people that do err in their heart and they have not known my ways. 40 years, says Psalm 95. And Acts 13 says, the God of this people brought them out of Egypt, and about the time of 40 years suffered he their manners in the wilderness. So the scripture was quite specific about the time period of the first Exodus. It was a complete cycle of probation. And I think we've got scriptural warrant for believing that the same time period will apply to the second Exodus. Now, notice what it says in Micah chapter 7, verse 15. It says, according to the days of thy, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, will I show unto him marvelous things. Now, in the Hebrew, that phrase, according to the days, is just one Hebrew word, kemi, as it's put down there. Now, it's been argued that kemi perhaps relates more to the character of the Exodus journey. According to the remarkable things that happened in the first Exodus, so things will likewise be seen in the second Exodus to come. But kemi can mean more than that. Kemi can be a word that definitely means according to the number of the days. Now, let me give you a couple of illustrations of that. If you come back to Leviticus chapter 12, we're told this in terms of the matter of the purification of men and women. It says this in Leviticus chapter 12, verse 2. Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a woman have conceived seed and born a man-child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, according to the days of her separation, for her infirmity shall she be unclean. According to the days, kimi, same word. And clearly the word kimi in Leviticus 12 verse 2, according to the days, means according to the number of the days, the 7 days that are marked out here for her uncleanness. That's the same word in Micah chapter 7. Here's another one in Isaiah 23. If you come to Isaiah 23 in the story of the of Tarshish, really, Isaiah 23 says this, in the 15th verse, it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king, and after the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. So there it is again. Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days, kimi, of one king. And at the end of 70 years. So it would be very clear from Isaiah 23 verse 15 that the word kimi, according to the days, means according to the number of the days. And so on this basis, we believe that Micah 7 should be applied to the time period of the first Exodus, because it's been so specifically identified in Scripture. 40 years, 40 years, 40 years. According to the days, says Micah, of that first Exodus, so shall it be in the second. And so we believe that there will be a 40-year period of wilderness probation that marks out this second Exodus journey. God will test them and prove them. But here's the thing. That period of probation is going to come to an end. And what happens at the finish of the 40 years is what our study is, God willing, going to focus on this morning. Because this morning, now, finally, after that 40 years of wandering, we're going to be brought to the moment of that occasion when the house of Israel will come finally to the borders of their land. Now, let me draw attention to what Brother Thomas says in Mystery of the Covenant, page 33. He says, at the end of 40 years, end of that sojourning period in the people's wilderness, Elijah conducts the tribes to the borders of the land. Oh, so do you notice Brother Thomas came to the same conclusion about the 40-year period, based incidentally on the same reading of Micah chapter 7. He'd already worked that out. But here he explains that the second Exodus will therefore follow the pattern of the first, and they march through the wilderness of the peoples before they finally congregate at the borders of the land. You know, brothers and sisters, it's very difficult for us to really imagine the stress and anxiety of those years. I think we can all understand that there will be no doubt all the horrors of previous epochs when anti-Semitism has resulted in Jewish ghettos, Jewish incarcerations, Jewish pogroms, anti-Jewish propaganda. And yet again, for the Jewish people, to quote Chaim Weizmann, the world will be divided into places where they cannot live and places where they cannot enter. The Jews have always been caught in the middle of nowhere, nowhere to go. And the heart weeps at what this will mean for the house of Israel in these 40 years. But we've got to remember, we need to remember, that the purpose of this journey is to turn the hearts of the children to the faith of their fathers until they finally come to trust, fully trust in Yahweh their God. And this is what the saints who are with Elijah will be working with to achieve, as the pastors who work with the house of Israel in all their wanderings. And then Brother Thomas says this. He says, it would seem that the tribes march from the south toward the Red Sea and from the west, north, and east to the Euphrates flood, from which two points they form a junction in the intermediate wilderness. They are gathered from all points of the compass, and having to congregate from such opposite directions, they will no doubt move, fighting their way through the countries and coalescing as occasion may serve until they arrive at their destination. Do you notice that Brother Thomas now deliberately uses a different term? He now adds the word, or the phrase, the intermediate wilderness. Oh, that's not the same, you see, as the people's wilderness. What Brother Thomas is suggesting is there comes a moment of time where that 40 years probation has ended, and there's a change, not only of circumstance, but of locality. That wherever the people's wilderness has been, and incidentally we might say that even though the wilderness of the people is essentially centered in Europe, that there's Catholics everywhere, in all parts of the world, and as the Jews travel through the countries of the world en route first to Europe, and then from thence back to Israel, there'll be opposition wherever they go. There might be a metaphorical element, as it were, to the people's wilderness. But this term, the intermediate wilderness, refers to the physical territories on either side of Israel. Because these two parts now are going to become the gathering points for the returning Jews. And when Brother Thomas says in that statement that they're at the borders of the land, it tells us that they're so agonizingly close now to the end of their journey. One last push for home. Well, that brings us to the first quotation that Brother Thomas is now going to make reference to in outlining this last stage of the Odyssey of the House of Israel. And yet again, he's going to bring together a magnificent set of Bible passages, brothers and sisters, that I think form the basis for his thinking and his exposition, because it's all laid out in Mystery of the Covenant. I think that Brother Thomas himself must have been so excited to study these matters and to see the scriptures come alive, as one passage called to another, and he brought them together until the picture was fully formed. Well, here's the first of those passages. It's in Isaiah chapter 27. Now, Isaiah 27, incidentally, is absolutely about the return and the purging of Jacob in the future. That's the very theme of Isaiah 27. And just notice a couple of things. Isaiah 27 verse 6, for example, says, "He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the earth with fruit." That's going to be the burden of the prophet's words on this occasion. And likewise, verse 9, "By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged, and this is all the fruit to take away his sin." This is all about the future return and purging of Jacob. And the last two verses, which are the verses we want to pay attention to, are set, therefore, in the context of the final journey into the promised land. The rebels have all been purged, and the company that's left, well, it's the faithful remnant. And these are the very ones whom Elijah is now going to conduct to the entrance of the land itself. And so Isaiah 27 verse 12 says, "It shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt." Now, that word "beat off" is an interesting word. It actually means to beat out or to thresh. To beat out or to thresh. But the sense of the word relates to the gleaning of a crop in small quantities. It's used of beating out an olive tree in Deuteronomy 24, verse 20. It's used of beating out wheat by hand in Judges 6, verse 11. It's used of beating out barley by hand in Ruth chapter 2, verse 17. And Brother Thomas's own translation of that phrase is, and it's an interesting one, but it's absolutely correct, "Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit," because that's the actual meaning of the Hebrew word. And the translation will be justified by how the verse itself will unfold. And so where will he gather this fruit from? Well, the answer is from two different directions, from the channel of the river and from the stream of Egypt. Now, the word "river" here in Isaiah 27, verse 12, in the Hebrew is Har Nahar. And some of you will know that that almost invariably is used of the river Euphrates. Not always, but on most occasions, and especially where it's just used with the definite article but no other description. The channel of the river. The river, it's got to be the Euphrates. And so this is the assembly point, we believe, to the north of Israel that will be chosen. but at the other end it says unto the stream of Egypt. And so Egypt is going to be the southern assembly point to the south of Israel, where the collection point will be for the house of Israel together. In fact, the verse goes on to say at the end of the verse, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O children of Israel. Well, that word gathered is interesting as well, because the word in the Hebrew, lachat, means to pick up that which is left behind. That is, to glean. So it's a very similar idea to the word beat out earlier in the verse. So these two words tell us that there will be both a gathering and a gleaning, so that no stragglers are left behind, one by one. So the divine providence is at work here to make sure that none is lost, and that each individual in the faithful remnant that remains is going to be brought safely on this final step. These are the good ones, brothers and sisters. These are the ones that are left. This is the remnant that God wants. So he takes care that not a single one of them is lost on this last stage now of the journey. And so verse 13 says, and it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown. Now, incidentally, the margin has a very good cross-reference there, which we'll come to shortly in Matthew 24, because this is not the trumpet that sounds the call to the resurrection of the saints in the 1st of Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 16. That's not the trumpet here. This trumpet is the Jubilee trumpet that proclaims liberty to Israel and calls on them to return to the land of their possession. Now, let's just follow that thought through in terms of the significance, therefore, of this trumpet. Because, it comes from Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus 25, verses 9 and 10 says, then thou shalt cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound. It shall be a Jubilee unto you. And as a result of that trumpet sound, it says, what will they do? They shall return. Does that sound Elijah-like? They shall return, every man to his possession. That's the trumpet that we believe is blowing on this occasion. And we suggest that it's the same trumpet that's referred to in Isaiah chapter 18, verse 3. See ye, when he lifteth up an ensign upon the mountains, and when he bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. Now, Isaiah 18 is about the destiny of the Jewish nation, a nation scattered and peeled, it says. And the prophet calls upon the world to recognize two great signs that God is at work to recover his people. The witness of the ensign, see ye, is placed in the land among the house of Judah. But the witness of the trumpet, hear ye, is going to be blown before the house of Israel. This is their call to return. And so this is where Isaiah 27, therefore, is drawing the same idea from. Isaiah 27, verse 13 says, and it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come, says the record. And they shall come because the trumpet's calling them to return. And so Isaiah 27 says in verse 13 there, that when that trumpet's blown, they that were ready to perish shall come. Who's they that were ready to perish? Well, it's the Jewish people en route to Israel as they fight their way home. Now, the word trumpet in each of those three passages is the same word. Which trumpet do you think this might be? Well, it's the shofar. It's the ram's horn, famous for its sound in calling Israel to their God. And that's the trumpet in each of these three places. We believe it's the Jubilee call to the people of God. And now, the cross-reference in the margin. Now, the cross-reference in the margin says, see Matthew chapter 24, verse 31. That's a cracker of a cross-reference. Because in Matthew 24, this is the very context of the phrase, because it says there, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds. Now, in that verse in Matthew, the angels are the saints, and the elect are the house of Israel, who are going to be regathered from the four winds of heaven. In fact, what it says there in Matthew 24 is from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And that statement in Matthew 24 has an Old Testament basis, because Zechariah chapter 2, verse 6 says, Flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh, concerning Israel, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of heaven. Zechariah 2, verse 6. Oh, yes, this is the children of Israel that Matthew 24, verse 31 is talking about. This is about the regathering of scattered Israel. And this is the Jubilee trumpet of return. And incidentally, don't you think that Matthew 24 is another passage, therefore, that indicates that there will be saints that go forth with Elijah on his mission? These are the angels of this verse. Well, it says here in Isaiah 27 that the great trumpet shall be blown. Now, that phrase might be figurative, but, you know, you wonder whether the saints, those immortal associates of Elijah, might cause the very sound of the shofar itself to be heard in every community that's part of the house of Israel. That when the saints go out to all the world of the house of Israel, then in every synagogue, every collection place where there are Jewish people, that there's a sound of a trumpet, a sound of a shofar melody that they know. Who knows, brothers and sisters? But above that, of course, the very proclamation which the saints bring will represent the shofar call to those of Israel. And that call will work, it says, because, well, verse 13 goes on to say that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come. They shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and those who were the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and they'll come to worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So in response to the shofar blast, those of the Jewish people with the right heart, they'll be on the journey of return. But what Isaiah 27 is telling us is that they will begin to congregate at the two opposite ends of the intermediate wilderness. Some in Assyria, marked by the river Euphrates, and some in Egypt, marked by the river Nile. And what this geographical description tells us is that the 40 years of probation has now come to an end, and the final stage of the journey has begun. Well, that takes us to Isaiah chapter 11. Because if you come back to Isaiah chapter 11, we've got further detail now that's added concerning this particular matter. The geographical movement of the nation at this point. Isaiah 11 says, and in verse 15, and Yahweh shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Now, the tongue of the Egyptian sea is the bay at the northern extremity of the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. And it was in this area that Israel crossed in the first Exodus. So that marine bay will be physically changed, says Isaiah, to permit the crossing of the house of Israel when they arrive at this point. But not only will that moment or that place in the Egyptian sea be changed, it goes on to say, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men to go over dry shod. So here again, the word is ha-nahar, which we believe refers to the river Euphrates. This is the Har-Nahar. And there are two reasons for suggesting this. As we mentioned before, when the term is used with the definite article but without any other qualification, it most often refers to the Euphrates. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21 is a good example. But the second thing, do you notice in this verse, is that the effect of smiting this river in verse 15 is so that there might be a highway for his people from Assyria in verse 16. Now, creating a highway from Assyria can only occur when the obstacle of the mighty stream of the Euphrates has been made fordable. So it's going to be smitten into seven streams to facilitate the passage of his people. But the very language of this intervention in Isaiah is drawn from the first Exodus. Because with his mighty wind is an allusion to Exodus 14, verse 21, and making men go over dry shod is an allusion to Exodus 14, verse 29. So just as Yahweh showed his power to help his people cross the water in the first Exodus, so he will smite the Euphrates to help the house of Israel cross the water in the second Exodus. And now verse 16 says that as a result of those physical adjustments, there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came out of Egypt. So the highway runs south from Syria and north from Egypt. But the purpose of the highway is to convey the returning Jews on their journey home, back to the centre where the two halves of the highway will meet. And did you notice who goes on this? The remnant of his people which shall be left. Now that word left there, sha'ar, to be left over or to survive, is the same word that we found used of the refined third of the house of Judah in Zechariah 12 and verse 14. But now, at the end of their journey, this is a reference to the refined remnant, those that are left of the house of Israel. And the implication of these passages is that Yahweh will prepare the way for their return. Well, there's another passage that's deeply significant in this regard, and that's Zechariah chapter 10. Now, all of these, remember, are actually enunciated in the mystery of the covenant. But it's Brother Thomas that brings these together so wonderfully and so well in his exposition of this moment of time. So in the prophecy of Zechariah and chapter 10, which Brother Thomas draws attention to, we read these words starting from the 8th verse. Zechariah 10 verse 8 says, "And I will hiss for them and gather them." That word hiss means to hiss or to whistle, and it's a reference to the shepherd's pipe. So the shepherds had a little whistle that they would blow, and their sheep knew the sound of their shepherd's pipe. So this is the call of the shepherd to the flock. And the shepherd's pipe that calls the flock is really another way of describing the shofar horn that calls his people. So when the time is right, the house of Israel will hear that call. Because do you notice that this verse says, God doesn't just promise to call them, he also promises to gather them. And not only to gather them, but also to redeem them. And Zechariah 10 verse 9 goes on to say, "And I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries." But the Revised Standard Version reads it just slightly differently, and I think it's helpful. The Revised Standard Version says, "Though I have sown them among the people, they shall remember me in far countries." And if we were to ask what causes them to remember God, I think the answer is that the proclamation of the Elijah mission has now reached their country. This is Elijah's work. Or notice the key word at the end of the verse that tells us that. "They shall live with their children and turn again. I'll send you Elijah that he might turn the hearts of the children to their fathers." What we're being told here is that the Elijah mission has reached each place, each land, each country, the shepherd's pipe. And so Zechariah 10, verse 10 says, "And I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria." Now we know that the house of Israel is going to be gathered from all four corners of the earth. So Zechariah 10 verse 10 is not saying that Egypt and Assyria are the only places where Jews will come back from. It's saying that these are the two collection points where they will assemble to before this last stage of the journey. So that's where they're going to come out from. But into, well, the next part of the verse goes on to say, "I'll bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them." So the swelling influx of the house of Israel will result in an enormous increase of the Jewish population that will spread both to the east, Gilead, and to the west, Lebanon, in order to fill up the land. Now, in terms of the numbers in 2025, as best as we're able to ascertain, the current Jewish population worldwide is estimated at 15.8 million. Those in the land, the house of Judah, number approximately 7.3 million. These are just the Jewish part of the population. And that's about 45% of all Jewry. And those in diaspora, the house of Israel, number 8.5 million, which is about 55%. So there are still more Jews who live outside the land than who live inside the land. But the birth rate of Jews living in the land, incidentally, is much higher than those living in diaspora. But when the house of Israel arrives, it's going to more than double the Jewish population of the land. And so Zechariah 10 verse 11 says, "And he shall pass through the sea with affliction." Maybe we should just read that again. "And he shall pass through the sea." That's a reference to God. So Yahweh himself but in the person of Elijah and the saints, will travel with his people in crossing the sea of distress. And again, as part of the divine preparation for the journey of his people, what we're being told now in Zechariah chapter 10 and verse 11 is that God will prepare these two entry points into the promised land. And the language describes the same two places, but this time Zechariah uses the opposite terms, strangely enough, to Isaiah. So he starts by saying, he shall smite the waves in the sea. Now, the word Yam Sea is often used of the Mediterranean, but it's not the Mediterranean being referred to here. It's a phrase or a term that's also used of large rivers, and it's used of the Euphrates. Now, just listen to this phrase in Jeremiah 51 and verse 42 concerning the Euphrates. It says, "The sea is come up upon Babylon. She is covered with the multitude of the waves thereof." And the Sea of Babylon was the River Euphrates, with its canals and its lakes and its marshes. Every year, the inundations of the Euphrates flooded the whole Mesopotamian plain. Well, all the waves of that sea, says Zechariah, will be smitten. The Euphrates will be restrained so that God's people might cross over. And then he says Zechariah, all the deeps of the river shall dry up. But this time the Hebrew is not ha-nahar, as in the river Euphrates. It's the Hebrew word ye'or, which is a reference to the river Nile. It's the standard word used for the river Nile. And so just as the sea of waves will be smitten, so the depths of the river will be dried up, and the river Nile will be reduced so that God's people might pass over. And you see, the taming of the two rivers really symbolizes the subduing of the two powers. So it says at the end of the verse, the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, he shall smite the waves in the sea, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away, the deeps of the river shall dry up. So in preparation for the movement of the house of Israel, these two powers are going to be humbled. Now we realize that today, Egypt and Assyria, well, they're not nations of consequence. But in the prophet's day they were, and they represented the two great superpowers of the age, a power grouping both to the north and to the south of Israel. Well, these two power groups are going to be present, aren't they, at the time of the end, in the form of the king of the north and the king of the south. And both those alliances of power are going to be humbled as part of God's clearing of the way for his people to return. So verse 12 says, and I'll strengthen them in Yahweh, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith Yahweh. And the phrase to walk up and down refers to the house of Israel journeying throughout the earth as they will have been for the previous 40 years. But they will have journeyed in God's name, says the record, and they'll be strengthened at every step of the way with his providential hand leading them onwards towards Zion. What a marvelous passage, brothers and sisters, for Brother Thomas to have drawn attention to in Zechariah chapter 10. But there's another one in Isaiah chapter 19. Now, Isaiah 19 adds further detail to the story of this journey through the intermediate wilderness, which is exactly what these passages are making reference to. Because in Isaiah 19, and reading from verse 23, it says this, "In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians." Now notice that it says that the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and presumably the Egyptian shall come into Assyria. This is a literal highway, and it's going to be used from both ends to facilitate the movement of people. The Assyrian will come down that highway into Egypt, and the Egyptian will come up that highway into Assyria. But now the purpose of the highway is going to be made clear. Verse 24. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. Do you know, at first sight, that statement, Israel shall be the third, sort of sounds surprising, really, doesn't it? Surely we'd expect Israel to be the first, not just the third, and certainly not the third as in third equal with Egypt and Assyria. But that's not what the phrase means. And the context supplies the proper interpretation, because it says, Israel shall be the third, even a blessing in the midst of the land. So Egypt and Assyria represent the rest of the world grouped around Israel, which will become the intermediary between the nations. So far from suggesting that Egypt and Assyria will have equality with Israel, it teaches Israel supremacy. They are at the centre of it all. And by means of this highway, all nations, as it were, will be able to sweep into the centre to converge upon the third part, Israel, who rules in the midst. Because notice we're expressly told that Egypt and Assyria will be in servitude, verse 23. And that is a result of having their power broken, said Zechariah chapter 10, verse 11. And so verse 25 says, whom Yahweh of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of mine hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. So as part of the sheep nations accepted into the kingdom, Egypt and Assyria will be recognized for their new relationship with God. But only Israel can ever be described as Yahweh's inheritance. That's Deuteronomy chapter 32, isn't it? Verse 9. For Yahweh's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Their relationship with him is unique. So here's a wonderful collection of passages that all speak about the journey of Israel through this intermediate wilderness. It's quite remarkable, really, isn't it, brothers and sisters, the detail that Scripture provides. And it's probably helpful for us to see the topography, because I think it leads us to several conclusions that we might draw. This is all about the highway to Israel. And so what we're being told here is that to the north lies the power of Assyria, and of course at the other end to the south lies the power of Egypt. And if we were to ask why Assyria and why Egypt, it's because they're being used to represent the entire world from opposite directions in relation to Israel. You see, Israel lies at the center as the third part in the midst of the land. And every other nation in the world will be considered to be either north or south of the Holy Land, because Israel will be the point from which the location of every other nation is identified. You're either north of Israel or south of Israel, because Israel's the center of it all. But the geography of the region tells us something else, don't you think? Because, you see, to the north lies the river Euphrates, and to the south lies the river Nile. And what that means is that when the Jews of the house of Israel arrive at these two places, they must all participate in an act of national baptism if they are to continue their journey. They have to cross the rivers. In the case of Egypt, they'll also march across the tongue of the Red Sea. And you know, I think that act of baptism was anticipated by the prophet. We shan't turn it up, but Isaiah 51 verses 9 to 11 says, awake, awake, put on thy strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it which hath dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a way for the ransomed to pass over? Therefore the redeemed of Yahweh shall return and come with singing unto Zion. And the implication is that in the second Exodus there will be another journey through the depths of the sea. So God selected the very topography of this region so that the principle of national baptism might be reenacted. And I think also, when we think about the journey from the side of Assyria, for those crossing the river Euphrates, they will memorialize the crossing over of Abraham. And for those journeying from Egypt, they will memorialize the exodus of Israel. There's something wonderfully significant about all of this, isn't there, brothers and sisters? And just notice that the boundaries that are shown here are not just Assyria and Egypt, but specifically the River Euphrates and the River Nile, both of which are referred to in these passages we've just looked at about the highway. But the mention of those two places is deeply significant. When we remember these words were spoken to Abraham in Genesis 15, verse 18. In the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt, the Nile, unto the great river, the river Euphrates." So these rivers define the dimensions of the land promised to Abraham. So in crossing at these two points, the house of Israel have already entered the land of promise. When they enter the highway in the intermediate wilderness, it's the sign that their probation in the wilderness of the peoples is over. Now, there's a tendency, I think, to spiritualize these prophecies about the highway. That's certainly what Christianity would do. It teaches that the highway is the path of the church. But the house of Israel is literally saved from their literal enemies, and they literally return to the land on a literal highway. There's no spiritual type without the natural. You can't have a symbolic highway without a real one. Oh, yes, it might symbolize the way of the truth, but the primary application of these prophecies is to that physical highway. It's a real road for real people. They're called Israel, and it's built for them to travel on. Now, just see how specific the prophecy was, that Isaiah in particular was, about this extraordinary road that will sweep through the desert, built under the superintendence of our Lord Jesus Christ. Because he's got 40 years to get this ready, hasn't he? During the same time that the temple's going to be built, there'll be other people commissioned to build this highway in preparation for the returning house of Israel. So what the prophet tells us in Isaiah 35 verse 7 is that it is grassed. In Isaiah 35 verse 8 that it's holy. In Isaiah 35 verse 9 that it's protected. In Isaiah 40 verse 3 that it's straight. In Isaiah 62 verse 10 that it's level. In Isaiah 62 verse 10 that it's elevated. And in Isaiah 43 verse 19 that it's watered. These are all aspects of the literal highway on which the returning Israelites will walk. Oh, notice the last item, because, well, it's the sign that Yahweh will make every provision for the needs of his people on this journey, because there will be water in the wilderness, this wilderness in particular. Isaiah 35, the wilderness, in the wilderness shall waters break out. Isaiah 41, I'll make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs. Isaiah 43, I will make even a way in the wilderness, that's where our title comes from, and rivers in the desert. Jeremiah 31 says, I'll cause them to walk by the rivers of waters. So you see, the whole picture is of God's abiding love and care for his people. The probation in the wilderness of the peoples is at an end. The purging is now complete. So now the blessings might start. But what a stupendous work this will be, because the desert will be transformed. And so will their own hearts and minds. Do you know that whole area has always been desolate and arid, and all just waiting for this day when God brings water. Because when there's water, there'll be growth. And if there's growth, there'll be food. And the wilderness will become a fruitful field. We can just imagine, can't we, the joy of different branches of the family of the house of Israel meeting up on the highway and comparing experiences, and the laughter and happiness of knowing that, well, that they're almost at journey's end. So what we really have here in these passages is what we might describe as the highway of return. Now, here's some passages that are relevant then to that. Isaiah 11 verse 16, which we've already read, said, there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people. Now, you see that word highway, I've said in the Hebrew here, it's the word mesila. It's a very interesting word, because it isn't just any sort of road. It means a thoroughfare as turnpiked. In other words, it refers to a road on which a toll is collected at a toll gate. So this isn't a road that anyone can travel on. Only those who've paid the toll can enter the highway and begin their journey. And for this road, the toll will be paid by entering the waters of baptism to declare the righteousness of God. This is the highway that the remnant of God's people will travel on. And now, do you remember this? Isaiah 40, verse 3. The voice of him that crieth, in the wilderness prepare ye the way of Yahweh, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Messilah. Now, we know that this prophecy was quoted in the Gospels and applied to John the Baptist, who came as the messenger to the house of Judah. But the ultimate outworking of the prophecy clearly relates, don't you think, to Elijah coming to the house of Israel. And this reference to the highway in the desert and the way of Yahweh in the wilderness proves it. It's Elijah's work to lead the house of Israel on that highway home. And only then will the words of Isaiah 40 find their proper fulfillment. Isaiah 62 says this, verse 10, Go through the gates, prepare ye the way, cast up the highway, Messilah, gather out the stones, lift up a standard. Now I think the gate here in Isaiah 62 verse 10 isn't the gate to a city, it's the gate to the highway. It's the point where the highway can be entered. That word cast up there, salal, means to bank up, and it relates to the construction of an elevated highway. It's the building of a road which is higher than the adjacent ground. In fact, our best English word to describe that would be a causeway. And the gathering out of all the stones means that this highway is not only raised above the ground, but it's level and even so that a multitude can travel along and upon it safely. Jeremiah 31 verse 21 says, Set thee waymarks, make thee heaps, set thine heart toward the highway, the Messilah, even the way which thou wentest, turn again. And the word waymarks there in Jeremiah means a road mark that relates to a directional signpost, whereas the words high heaps is a word that means either guideposts or pillars. So what Jeremiah 31 is telling us is that this causeway has got guideposts to show the edge of the road and direction signs to confirm the destination. And Jeremiah sees that the children of Israel will be on this same highway as once they were in their first Exodus. He sees them travelling on it again, if they will but turn to God. And the wonderful thing about this highway is it's so well signposted that no one walking on it could ever get lost. What a remarkable set of prophecies about the highway of return. And now come to Isaiah 35. Because Isaiah 35 is not only appropriate for this moment of our consideration, but you might remember that we sang it by way of introduction this morning. Now we sing this hymn, don't we? A rose shall bloom in the lonely place, a wild shall echo with sounds of joy. The ransomed of God shall return to him with a chorus of joy to a gladsome lay. It's in the section, Christ and his kingdom. And we sing this and say, yes, that's us, journeying to the kingdom. And so it is. That's not the primary meaning, is it, of Isaiah 35? This chapter and that hymn are both about the house of Israel travelling on the highway with Elijah and the saints. And when we sing that hymn, we should feel the pull of the hope of Israel on us in asking our God that he will bring his people home as he's promised in this place. And in this chapter, therefore, after talking about the solitary place being glad, blossoming abundantly, waters in the wilderness, he then says this in Isaiah 35 verse 8. And an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. So one of the key aspects of the highway is that it will be protected from any unauthorized travelers. There'll be no threat to Israel from the unholy or the scornful or the profane. This road, at this moment at least, is reserved just for their use. But it shall be, goes on the phrase, goes on the verse, it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. Now, the King James Version is a little uncertain here, but perhaps Rotherham's is helpful. Rotherham's translates it this way: there shall not pass over it one who is unclean, but he himself shall be one of them travelling the road, and the perverse shall not stray therein. And you notice the margin supports that translation: for he shall be with them. And I think that the sense of that phrase is identical to the spirit of Isaiah 52 verse 12, which we've already seen: for Yahweh will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your reward. So Israel is accompanied on this journey, on this highway, by God, in the form of Elijah and the saints. And as a result of their protective and guiding influence, there'll be no intruders. So verse 10 says, and the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. This is the story, brothers and sisters, the story of the returning house of Israel. And that's what Isaiah 35 is about. In fact, something really interesting. Isaiah 19 verse 23, which we won't go back to, actually said that this highway will be used by others during the millennial age en route to Zion. It's built for the return of the house of Israel, but when the house of Israel are all gathered back into the land, the highway's still there. Well, says the prophet, it's going to be used by others during the kingdom age. Now, there's a tremendous lesson when you think about it. What we're being told, you see, is that the nations who desire salvation must walk on the highway of Israel. You couldn't have a more powerful way, could you, of impressing the world with the truth that Israel is the head of the nations, the key to happiness, other than the fact that those who wish to go up to Jerusalem to worship the great king must first walk on Israel's road. Only Israel has the way of the truth, and all nations will have to acknowledge that. Marvellous, really, isn't it? Well, we're on that way today. Not a literal highway, but the way of the truth. And if we want to guide Israel on that highway in the future, we need to demonstrate that we've been able to walk on that road today, to stay on track, to walk the line, to keep straight. In fact, maybe that's the key word when you think about it: walking in the straight way. We're asked to do that, you see. Psalm 5, verse 8 says, lead me, O Yahweh, in thy righteousness because of mine enemies. Make thy way straight before my face, so that I might walk, says David, in the right way. Please make your way, thy way, straight before my face, because it's the straight way that we want to walk on. Yorshah is the Hebrew word. Proverbs 3 verses 5 to 6 says, trust in Yahweh with all thine heart, lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall make straight thy paths. Proverbs 4 verses 25 and 27 say, let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before thee, Yorshah. Ponder the path of thy feet, and let all thy ways be established. It's the straight way that we want to try and walk on, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Oh, and just remember this. Isaiah 40, verse 3. The voice of him that crieth, in the wilderness prepare ye the way of Yahweh. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God, Yorshah. So here it is again. Isaiah 40 has such relevance to this story of the restoration of Israel, and also to ourselves. We want to walk on the straight way, brothers and sisters. If we're going to teach Israel how to walk on that way later on, we need to walk on it today. You know that the cherubim are famous for their sense of direction. Because Ezekiel 1 verse 12 says, according to the New Revised Standard Version, each moved straight ahead. Wherever the Spirit would go, they went without turning as they went. We need to be like cherubim. We need to walk straight ahead. That's what we need to do. It's part of our training to be the teachers and the pastors of Israel. And if we've learned the lesson of the straight path, then we'll be able to offer this advice to the house of Israel as they travel on the highway. You'll remember these words from Isaiah 30, verses 20 and 21. Thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when ye turn to the right hand or to the left. It's a funny thing, you know, but human nature always does want to turn to the right or the left, just to see what lies off the path. The way of the truth is worn the most at the edges. Walking down the centre line requires three things: focus, balance, and momentum. But that's what we're asked to do. And the best way to walk the straight path is for our eyes to look right on. So what one thing could we do you think, that might help us each day to walk a straighter line to the kingdom? Well, the simple and best answer is to read the word. Because even if we don't understand completely the meaning of our daily portion, what the Bible does, what the scriptures do, is they shine a spotlight on the center line. Because every day the word reminds us of the difference between good and evil, holy and profane, right and wrong, and we need that. We absolutely need it every day in our lives. Well, what a journey that will be, brothers and sisters, for the house of Israel when they travel on this highway to their ultimate destination. But there are still some unanswered questions. Because after all, there must come a time when the travelers arrive, and the moment the house of Israel comes off the highway and crosses the Jordan River, they'll come face to face with the house of Judah, who are already in the land. Now, those terms, Judah and Israel, don't just indicate a difference between those in the land and those in diaspora. The terms Judah and Israel also refer to a spirit of rivalry and hostility that has existed between the two kingdoms for centuries. Israel and Judah were ancient foes who fought each other frequently. And do you know what's surprising? That even today, many Jews living elsewhere in the world are highly critical of some of the things that the Jews living in the land get up to. So how will the deep divisions of the house of Judah and the house of Israel be healed? What circumstances might bring about such a transformation that the whole Jewish nation might be reorganized and reinstated as the 12 true tribes of ancient times? Well, that, God willing, happens to be the very subject of our study tomorrow.